You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 450th episode of our Civil War podcast. I'm Rich.
And I'm Tracy. Hello y'all. Thanks for tuning into the podcast.
On the cold night of January 2nd, 1864, most of the Confederate Army of Tennessee's ranking generals huddled around the fireplace inside Army headquarters at Dalton, Georgia. Four of them, Major Generals W.H.T. Walker and Alexander Stewart, and Brigadier Generals Patton Anderson and William Bate were supporters of the beleaguered General Braxton Bragg, who had resigned after the Confederate debacle at Missionary Ridge.
Across the room, Major Generals Thomas Heineman and Patrick Claiborne sat alone talking. Both of them had supported the ranking officers who petitioned Confederate President Jefferson Davis for Bragg's removal from command. Major General Carter Stevenson was the only general present who had remained neutral in the controversy.
Soon, General Joseph E. Johnston, the Army of Tennessee's slim and dapper new commander, entered the room, followed by Lieutenant General William Hardee. Johnston greeted the gathered officers warmly, then took a seat and turned the meeting over to Hardee, who announced that Claiborne had prepared a proposal on an important subject and wanted to present it to them for discussion.
Patrick Claiborne rose, unfolded a sheaf of papers, and began to read in a soft Irish brogue tempered by 14 years of living in the South. As the other officers listened, they realized Claiborne was suggesting something radical, nothing less than the eventual abolition of slavery in the South and a plan to solve the Confederate military's manpower crisis by recruiting slaves into the Army in exchange for their freedom.
Patrick Claiborne was born in County Cork, Ireland on March 16, 1828. His father was a Protestant physician, and his mother was the daughter of a prominent Irish Protestant family. Before he was 2 years old, Patrick's mother died, and his father remarried the children's tutor. From age 12 to 15, Patrick attended a private school, but after his father died in 1843, the family could no longer afford the school fees, and he took a job as an apothecary's, or druggist's, assistant. Later, at age 17, he traveled to Dublin to seek admission in the Apothecaries' College. After failing the entrance exam, he joined the British Army.
He served in the ranks of the 41st Regiment of Foot for 3.5 years. Despite promotion to corporal, it was an unhappy duty. Instead of journeying to far-off exotic lands, the regiment was assigned to policing duty to keep the peace in an Ireland ravaged by the potato famine. In 1849, when he was 21, Claiborne purchased his discharge when he inherited a small legacy from his father's estate.
3 months later, Patrick immigrated to America with his two brothers, William and Joseph, and his sister, Anne. The siblings landed in New Orleans on Christmas Day, 1849, then scattered to various parts of the United States. After a brief stay in Cincinnati, Ohio, Claiborne settled in Helena, Arkansas, where he managed a drugstore and later became a lawyer.
In Helena, Claiborne became a close friend of Thomas Hindman, a noted Democratic politician and future Confederate general. In May 1856, Hindman asked Claiborne to accompany him to the home of a political rival where Hindman believed he may be assaulted. Claiborne agreed. As the two men, both armed, walked to their destination, they were ambushed. A gunfight erupted, during which Claiborne and Hindman were shot and seriously wounded. Claiborne shot and killed his assailant before collapsing. Following his recovery, he was cleared of all charges in the incident.
In January 1861, Claiborne joined a local militia company, the Yell Rifles, and was soon elected the outfit's captain. After the outbreak of war, when the Yell Rifles became one of the companies in the 1st Arkansas Infantry, Claiborne was elected the regiment's colonel. In October 1861, the regiment mustered into Confederate service as the 15th Arkansas Infantry, with Claiborne remaining its colonel.
After the 15th Arkansas was brigaded together with three other regiments in a division commanded by William Hardee, it wasn't long before Hardee recommended Claiborne for command of the brigade. Promoted to brigadier general in March 1862, Claiborne saw his first important action the next month in the Battle of Shiloh. His brigade was in the first line during the surprise Confederate attack on the morning of April 6th. Despite heavy casualties, he pressed his command forward until nightfall, when his troops bivouacked on the battlefield.
The next morning, Ulysses S. Grant's counterattack forced Claiborne's brigade back along with the rest of the rebel army. Of the 2,750 men in his six regiments, 1,043 were killed, wounded, or missing, losses of 38%. Claiborne's leadership in this, his first battle, was marked more by enthusiasm than judgment, but he absorbed several valuable lessons that he subsequently applied in other battles, in particular, developing a specialized group of sharpshooters to accompany his brigade, and the use of artillery to support the infantry's advance.
During the Confederate invasion of Kentucky in the late summer of 1862, Claiborne commanded a small division consisting of his own brigade and another. His division led the army's advance northward from Knoxville, Tennessee, to Richmond, Kentucky, where Claiborne's command played a central role in defeating and pursuing a federal division on August 29th and 30th.
During the battle, Claiborne received a painful wound when a bullet pierced his left cheek, knocked out several teeth, and exited his mouth. When he returned to duty, a short, neatly trimmed beard covered the scar on his cheek. He recovered in time to participate in the Battle of Perryville on October 8th. While leading a furious and successful charge, Claiborne was wounded again, this time in the leg, and his horse was killed.
Claiborne was promoted to Major General in mid-December 1862. On December 31st, at the Battle of Stones River, outside Murfreesboro, Tennessee, a fierce attack by Claiborne's division drove the Federal right wing back 3 miles. Claiborne pushed his men hard, keeping the pressure on the reeling Yankees, until, with his men running out of ammunition, darkness and lack of support brought his advance to a halt.
Braxton Bragg's decision to retreat and leave the enemy in control of the field angered many of his subordinates, who believed Bragg had managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, and the toxic command environment that had troubled the Army of Tennessee since the Kentucky campaign worsened. In defending his actions at Stones River, Bragg petitioned Claiborne for his candid opinion. Claiborne made an enemy of Bragg when he responded in writing, saying, quote, "You do not possess the confidence of the army in that degree necessary to secure success."
During the months that followed Stones River, when the Confederate and Federal armies were stalemated in Middle Tennessee, Claiborne used the time to good advantage, spending hours on the drill field polishing and sharpening the natural fighting spirit of the officers and men of the division.
The division's training and discipline, and Claiborne's outstanding leadership qualities were on full display during the terrible combat at the Battle of Chickamauga in September 1863. One of his staff officers would say, quote, "I never saw Claiborne before or afterward so demonstrative. He rode like a fury from brigade to brigade. Horse and rider seemed frenzied alike. The men responded to him. They were intoxicated by his appeals and example."
On the second and final day of the battle, Claiborne's division, against its commander's better judgment, was ordered to attack a portion of the enemy line where the Federals had erected strong field works. Though eventually repulsed, Claiborne's men hit the Yankee position so hard that enemy reinforcements had to be shuffled along the front.
The resulting confusion in the Federal line ultimately created a fatal gap that Longstreet's command burst through to crack open the enemy position. Chickamauga was a resounding Confederate victory, but Claiborne's division suffered heavy losses, losing almost 1,800 of the 5,100 men who had gone into the fight.
Patrick Claiborne and his hard-hitting troops received high praise from his superior, D.H. Hill, who said, quote, "I have never seen troops behave more gallantly than did this noble division."
Claiborne's growing reputation as the best division commander in the Army of Tennessee was boosted by his performance during the November 1863 battles for control of Chattanooga. Ordered by Bragg to reinforce Longstreet's advance on Knoxville, Claiborne and his men were recalled at the last moment and tasked with defending the north end of Missionary Ridge against William Tecumseh Sherman's Federals.
On November 25th, Claiborne's skillful use of the terrain at Tunnel Hill and the launching of several perfectly timed counterattacks frustrated the Yankees' repeated assaults, and by that evening, Sherman had been soundly defeated there at the north end of Missionary Ridge.
However, in the end, Claiborne's success counted for little when set against the complete collapse of the Confederate forces holding the center and southern end of the rebel line, when soldiers of George Thomas's Army of the Cumberland charged up Missionary Ridge without orders, routed the rebel defenders, and won the day for the Federals.
As the defeated Confederates headed for Dalton, Georgia, Claiborne was given the responsibility of commanding the rear guard and covering the army's retreat. He performed those duties superbly, as on November 27th, at Ringgold Gap, he beat back the attacks of Joseph Hooker's pursuing Federals, after which the Yankees gave up any hope of catching the Army of Tennessee.
Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals make eating better every day easy. Get started today and have a week of restaurant-quality, pre-prepared meals ready to go, like the yummy cilantro chicken we had last night. These are no-prep, no-mess meals that are 100% ready to heat and eat, so there's no prepping, cooking, or cleanup needed. You'll have over 35 different options a week to choose from, and there's even more to enjoy with over 55 nutrition-packed add-ons like snacks and smoothies and more that help you make your weekly meal planning even more delicious. Head to factormeals.com/civilwar50 and use code CIVILWAR50 to get 50% off. That's code CIVILWAR50 at factormeals.com/CivilWar50 to get 50% off.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The Nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
As the Army of Tennessee settled into winter quarters at Dalton, Georgia, and the calendar rolled over from 1863 to 1864, Patrick Claiborne's success at Tunnel Hill at the northern end of Missionary Ridge, and then commanding the Army's rear guard at Ringgold Gap, meant his own prestige was at an all-time high. But the Irish-born rebel general believed the Confederacy itself faced a bleak future.
1863 had not been a banner year for the Confederacy. Robert E. Lee's defeat at Gettysburg, Pemberton's loss at Vicksburg, and then Bragg's failure at Chattanooga seemed to Patrick Claiborne to be milestones on the rebellion's road to ultimate defeat. In Claiborne's mind, there was one and only one hope for the Confederates: arming and making soldiers of their slaves.
On January 2, 1864, when Claiborne stood at that meeting of the Army of Tennessee's high-ranking officers to read a proposal that he had been working on for several weeks, he knew he was presenting a radical plan and treading upon dangerous ground. But other Southerners had actually already raised the idea of making soldiers of the Confederacy slaves. After the fall of Vicksburg in July 1863, a few citizens of Mississippi and Alabama had also felt the despair that weighed on Claiborne. In September, the Jackson, Mississippian newspaper, dismayed by the Federals' use of increasing numbers of black troops, had opined, quote, "We must either employ the Negroes ourselves, or the enemy will employ them against us."
The Mobile Register decried the, quote unquote, "danger to the South from federal use of black soldiers." Its editor asked, "Why not, if necessity requires, meet them with the same fighting material?"
The Montgomery Weekly Mail urged its readers to bow to that same necessity, even if it was, quote, "revolting to every sentiment of pride and to every principle that governed our institutions before the war."
And in early December 1863, an extraordinary open letter, written by someone using the pen name Culloden, appeared in the Memphis Appeal, which at that time was being published in Georgia due to the Federals' occupation of Tennessee.
Culloden was, in fact, Claiborne's friend and fellow general, Thomas Hindman. In the letter published in the Appeal, Hindman argued that the time had come to arm the slaves and give them freedom in exchange for their service. Hindman viewed emancipation as a necessary and effective motivator, writing, "Let him feel that he defends his country as well as ours."
And so, Thomas Hindman suggested in print the essential points of the message that Patrick Claiborne would officially propose several weeks later. Although there's no direct evidence that they worked together on Hindman's suggestions or Claiborne's plan, the timing of Hindman's letter and Claiborne's proposal can hardly be a coincidence, and it's simply too much of a stretch to believe the two old friends hadn't been privately discussing the idea of arming the Confederacy slaves.
In any case, although the idea might not have been new, no one presented as thorough an argument for arming and freeing the slaves as Claiborne. At the January 2nd meeting, in his careful and lengthy proposal, he pointed to the lopsided relationship between the manpower resources of the Confederate and Union armies, because of which he said, quote, "our soldiers can see no end except in our own exhaustion."
Claiborne's conclusion was simple. The rebel armies needed more men if the Confederacy was to win its independence. Because the pool of military-age white males was nearly exhausted, he therefore proposed, quote, that we immediately commence training a large reserve of the most courageous of our slaves, and further that we guarantee freedom within a reasonable time to every slave in the South who shall remain true to the Confederacy in this war."
Nor did Claiborne shrink from the further implications of his proposal. Quote, "If we arm and train him and make him fight for the country in her hour of dire distress, every consideration of principle and policy demand that we should set him and his whole race, who side with us, free."
Claiborne's antebellum experience as a lawyer was obvious as he countered possible objections and argued that slaves could make good soldiers. He urged prompt action on what he described as a, quote, "concession to common sense," end quote. He sharpened the choice to be made between victory and defeat by saying, quote, "As between the loss of independence and the loss of slavery, we assume that every patriot will freely give up the Negro slave rather than be a slave himself."
In other words, Claiborne was pointing out that the victorious Yankees would abolish slavery anyway. With his plan, the Confederacy would at least keep its independence. He made clear that the purpose of his rational and articulate proposal was not emancipation for its own sake, but rather as a means to achieve Confederate independence. But while Claiborne's proposal, to him, was only common sense, there were those at the January 2nd meeting who reacted to his plan with horror and outrage.
While Hindman spoke up in favor of Claiborne's proposal and mentioned ways black soldiers could be employed in the Confederate armies, W.H.T. Walker, Patton Anderson, Alexander Stewart, and William Bate roundly condemned the idea of arming the South slaves and giving them their freedom.
Stewart would declare that Claiborne's proposal was, quote, "at war with my social, moral, and political principles." Anderson, in a letter to his friend and fellow general Leonidas Polk, was beside himself with rage and wrote that Claiborne's idea was, quote unquote, "monstrous," and, quote, "revolting to Southern sentiment, Southern pride, and Southern honor."
Claiborne had hoped that his proposal would quickly be sent to Richmond for review and prompt action. Instead, he was disappointed when Joe Johnston declined to forward the document to the Confederate War Department on the grounds that it was more political than military in nature.
However, W.H.T. Walker, one of those who was outraged by Claiborne's proposal, wasn't content to let the matter rest. 1 week later, writing to all those in attendance at the meeting, Walker informed them that he would be taking the highly unusual step of going outside the chain of command and sending Claiborne's proposal to Richmond personally. He requested that each man reply with his opinion on Claiborne's plan for the record. Walker told them, quote, "I wrote to General Claiborne asking him for a copy of the article he read at our meeting on the night of the 2nd. I informed him that I felt it my duty to forward the documents to the War Department, which I intend to do. He has sent it and avowed himself its author. Will you please inform me whether you favor the proposition and sentiments of the document in any form?"
As promised, Walker sent Claiborne's proposal to Richmond. Responding to Walker on January 13th, Jefferson Davis wrote that he viewed Claiborne's ideas as, quote, "injurious to the public service, and that the best policy under the circumstances will be to avoid all publicity, and the Secretary of War has therefore written to General Johnston requesting him to convey to those concerned my desire that it should be kept private."
Secretary of War James Seddon's letter to Joe Johnston, dated January 21st, made it clear that Jefferson Davis and Seddon himself had taken grave offense at Claiborne's politically charged proposal. Seddon, speaking for Davis, instructed Johnston to communicate to all those in attendance at the January 2nd meeting and inform them that further discussion of the matter, quote, "can be productive only of discouragement, distraction, and dissension."
To make the point crystal clear, Seddon further instructed Johnston to communicate to all those who had been present at the meeting that, as far as Claiborne's proposal was concerned, Jefferson Davis desired, quote, the suppression of all discussion and controversy respecting or growing out of it.
Joe Johnston quickly sent his own circular to all his senior commanders, quoting Seddon's letter verbatim. Claiborne's aide, Captain Irving Buck, wrote, quote, upon receipt of this, General Claiborne directed me to destroy all copies of the proposal except the one returned from Richmond.
While official discussion on the issue of arming the Confederacy's slaves was ordered stopped, correspondence and behind-the-scenes conversations continued.
In this and past episodes, we've made references to the Army of Tennessee's toxic command environment, stemming mainly from conflicts between Braxton Bragg and those who sought to have him removed from command. And as we've seen, Patrick Claiborne was one of the many officers who had thought Bragg was unfit to command the army.
While Bragg's detractors in the Army of Tennessee must have been pleased with his departure after the disaster at Missionary Ridge and his replacement with Hardee, then Joe Johnston, they must have been horrified to learn of Bragg's appointment as Jefferson Davis's military advisor in Richmond.
When first informed of Claiborne's proposal, Bragg described it as, quote-unquote, treasonous. Even from Richmond, Braxton Bragg would continue his divisive influence on his former command, as he wrote to Walker, saying he wanted the names of all the, quote-unquote, traitors who had supported Claiborne's plan. In a March 1864 letter to Bragg, States Rights Gist, a brigade commander in Claiborne's division, wrote, I am delighted beyond expression to know the traitors will meet their just deserts at the hands of the powers that be.
Claiborne had clearly understood the potential negative consequences that might result from the presentation of his proposal. In fact, his aides had advised against it because they thought it likely it would destroy his prospects for promotion to lieutenant general and command of a corps.
Patrick Claiborne responded that, in view of the grave crisis threatening the Confederacy, he was duty-bound to present his proposal to the authorities, regardless of the effect upon his career. Writing many years later, Captain Buck would say that, quote, Claiborne naturally felt somewhat anxious as to the outcome of this affair, though feeling no regrets, and in discussing the matter and probabilities, said that the most disastrous result personally could only be court-martial and cashiering, and if such occurred, he would immediately enlist as a private in his old regiment, the 15th Arkansas, that he would at least do his duty in the ranks.
While he wasn't court-martialed and removed from command, there's strong reason to believe that Claiborne was denied promotion specifically on account of his proposal. After the Army of Tennessee entered winter quarters at Dalton, Georgia, many in the Army and elsewhere expected that Claiborne would receive a promotion to lieutenant general and be advanced to corps command. Certainly, Claiborne had proven himself to be the best division commander in the Army of Tennessee, and few were better qualified for corps command.
A staff officer in the division later wrote that, quote, the entire Army recognized the gallantry, devotion, and military prowess of Claiborne, and for a year prior, and up to the day of his death, officers and men were anxiously expecting his promotion to the grade of lieutenant general, and few, very few, knew why he was not so commissioned.
From June to September 1864, three corps commands were vacant in the Army of Tennessee, but none of them were offered to Patrick Claiborne.
Alexander Stewart and S.D. Lee were promoted to fill two of the slots, despite the fact that Claiborne was senior in rank to both. The last slot was filled by Major General Benjamin Cheatham, who would command Hardee's former corps, but without the promotion to lieutenant general that would normally go with such a posting. Patrick Claiborne remained a major general commanding a division, until his death at the Battle of Franklin, Tennessee on November 30th, 1864.
During the course of the podcast, we'll see that as the war went on and rebel fortunes continued to sink, discussion of arming and freeing the Confederacy's slaves will come up again. For example, in September 1864, in a letter to Secretary of War Seddon, Louisiana Governor Henry Allen was quite unequivocal when he wrote, "The time has come for us to put into the army every able-bodied Negro man as a soldier. This should be done immediately."
Unfortunately for Patrick Claiborne, few in January 1864 appreciated the pragmatism of his proposal, and fewer still supported it. As we'll see, there will come a point where Jefferson Davis and others, including Robert E. Lee, were desperate enough to implement a policy of making soldiers of the South's slaves, but by then, time had run out for the Confederacy. Up until the bitter end, though, there would be those who would rather see their attempt to establish a Southern slaveholding republic go down in flames rather than employ blacks as soldiers. Howell Cobb, first speaker of the Provisional Confederate Congress and later a Confederate general, wrote to James Seddon from Georgia in early 1865, declaring, "I think that the proposition to make soldiers of our slaves is the most pernicious idea that has been suggested since the war began. My first hour of despondency will be the one in which that policy shall be adopted. The day you make soldiers of them is the beginning of the end of the revolution. If slaves make good soldiers, our whole theory of slavery is wrong."
That means it's time for this episode's book recommendation, and our recommendation this time is Stonewall of the West, Patrick Claiborne and the Civil War by Craig L. Simons.
We just happen to be releasing this episode on St. Patrick's Day, so it seems appropriate, if just a coincidence, that the subject of this show is an Irishman who became a general in the Confederate Army. In any case, this biography of Patrick Claiborne is excellent and well worth a read for those of you who would like to learn more about him.
Don't forget you can find a list of all of our book recommendations if you head over to the podcast website, which is www.civilwarpodcast.org.
Also at the website, you can find info on joining the Strawfoot Brigade over on Patreon and supporting the podcast in that way. Just like the newest members, Donald R., Lydia K., Jesse D., Richard, and Papa B.
We also want to say thank you to Philip T. and Victor C. for their donations.
Yep, thanks, gentlemen. And thanks to all of you for listening to this episode of the podcast. Tracy and I do hope that you join us again next time, but until then, take care.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.